You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and this is my interview with the cinematographer for No Time to Die, Lena Sandgren.
Bond, any thug can kill. I have to know I can trust you.
Well, I understand 00s have a very short life expectancy.
You're a kite dancing in a hurricane, Mr. Bond.
Is this really what you want? Always alone?
We used to be able to get into a room with the enemy. And now they're just floating in the ether.
When her secret finds its way out, it'll be the death of you.
Oh my God. Target enough people.
Remember, people become the weapon.
Who is he?
James, you don't know what this is.
James Bond. License to kill. Love with Madeline Swan. I could be speaking to my own reflection. Only your skills die with your body. And life is all about leaving something behind. Isn't it?
Come on, Bond. Where the hell are you?
Don't do this. There will be nothing left to save.
I have to finish this. You have a flow artist?
No.
All right, well, let's start off here. Everyone, yep. I am being joined right now by Lena Sandgren, the Academy Award-winning cinematographer for No Time to Die. And Lena, first of all, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
Good, glad to hear it. I first want to start off by asking your first film here with Cary Joji Fukunaga, and it's a James Bond film, and it's the biggest film, dare I say, of your career so far. How does that phone call happen? How do you come on board such a project like this? And I know you're in demand, so I know that, you know, that's part of it. But I just want to know how this all came together for you.
I think it was a combination of different people that Cary knew had recommended me. I think he interviewed not only me, you know, it was other people in the loop. But we were just going to release First Man as well, which he was curious on. He had heard about, heard about it. And it just happened that we, on our first call, we just really synced. And that sometimes happens, you know, like you're just very much aligned in his vision of what he wanted to do with Bond, very much responded to, you know, how I see it. And I think we kind of, grew up with a similar sort of idea about films. Like we both love all kinds of films, all kinds of genres. Mm-hmm. And he also loves shooting on film. I love shooting on film. He wanted to take this into sort of trying to find sort of the Bond, look into what is like the soul of Bond, what is the heart of Bond, and and from all those films that has been done previously, and the core of Bond is like visually to him, it was like anamorphic 35. It's like it's color, it's escapism, it's adventure, and then in combination with Daniel Craig, that brought in all the more raw and intimate character. That has so much more layers, I think, even though I love the old ones for what they are, it's still like Daniel brought so much deeper emotions to the character that also is important to use in the film. But all we discussed in that first initial meeting was great. You know, it was so great. We really synced, and I think that helped. And then they got a private screening of First Man in London, Michael, Barbara, and Kerry, and they saw it, and I think he loved it. So that was sort of, they called me and, can you come in? And I was shooting a music video with Emma Stone and Paul McCartney, and Emma and Kerry also had just worked together on what was it called?
Maniac.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. And so it was a coincidence in one way. You know, it's always like this. It's like coincidences, and you come up perhaps in a discussion, and it just synced really well. And I flew over, and yeah, I was offered the job, and I could not resist. I think it was a great honor. You know, it's like, to me, it's a great honor. It was a great honor to be offered it, because I regard them, especially the last films, very highly for its quality. It has like great action, great drama, great storytelling with Daniel Craig's character acting like dramatic actor, really great. So, and obviously growing up with making Super 8 films as a teenager, you know, part of me is very inspired by that type of like from the romantic adventure and movies like Bond and Indiana Jones and so on. But also I had a father who was a distributor of art house film. So I saw a lot of art house film that I had like both of it in my hands. I went to watch Chinese movies in the theaters, and I saw, you know, the sort of teenage or movies that I also appreciated as a teenager. So it was all kinds of inputs and influences in my younger years that I think has affected me is in how I regard films and my choices of projects as well. You know, I can see beauty in many, many different type of films as well.
Yeah.
Hey there.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey.
We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of Sleepover Cinema,
our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon.
You've watched them in unforgettable adventures, love affairs, and tragedies. Now it's time to hear their own remarkable stories. From the makers of Death of a Rockstar and Death of a Sports Star, this is Death
Ready.
Of a Film Star.
And action.
Starring Heath Ledger, Marilyn Monroe, Chadwick Boseman, Robin Williams, Carrie Fisher, and Bruce Lee. Search for Death of a Film Star in your podcast app. You've seen them tell stories. Now it's time to tell theirs.
You mentioned, some of the work of your contemporaries, Hoyt Van Hoytema, Roger Deakins. It's like the bar has really been set in terms of
Sam Mendes directing. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Like, so I'm curious to know, like, coming on board this, Carrie's got his vision. You have your own style. There is precedent and an expectation now for the quality of these films. How does all of that come together to create the look that you all come up with for this film? Because I have to admit, one thing that I really appreciated about this particular film, and, you know, comparatively to all the others, is that you can tell that they're shot by different DPs. They don't have a unified look. They all have a unique look to them. So in that regard, do you ever feel like a sense of pressure or confusion as to like how this should look? Like, what do those conversations look like?
I think, I mean, there's a responsibility to be as great, you know, like as interesting and great and so on, of course, because it is a franchise and also just being a really big production comes with a lot of responsibility. But I think, I mean, I agree with you. They have distinctive different looks, and that's how it, I think, should be. It's like interesting that you as a team and filmmaker, the new filmmakers would give their sort of touch on things and in some sort of unique way. But I can just speak for myself. I don't think about the previous films when it comes to the look of what I'm doing with this. Mm-hmm. I think about this film the way, same way I try to approach any film, whether it's a super small film or large. I think it's always about, you know, the script, the vision of the director, obviously, is sort of the base foundation of what direction we're moving towards. And in this case, it was that adventurous, escapadic, grander, larger than life type of film that also had this storyline that is highly emotional when it comes to personal emotions with Bond, and he needs to be more raw and he needs to be sort of sensitive as well in scenes, and which a great drama has. And I think you, with the visuals, always have to base your visual storytelling on the actual emotions of the story and not on the literal story. And so you could think like, oh, how do you shoot all these big stunts or whatever? And sure, they're big. So what is the emotions in that scene? It's not, it's not just that it's big explosions. First of all, it needs to be written so that there's a context to why this is scary or why this is thrilling in that action sequence, right? So if the action sequence isn't built up by a story that is emotionally, you know, affecting you, it's very hard to shoot that anyway. You can't like just shoot a crazy explosion and think that people are going to like it if you shoot it in a cool way. I think that's even disturbing to me when you see films that just, you know, photograph things for the effect instead of, you know, for the effect itself, instead of the emotions of what's going on in the story. Right. So therefore, it's sort of kind of, with that approach, you could still say that, oh, well, this part of it should feel like breathtaking. That's the emotion. It may be just that. It may be breathtaking. That is the emotion. So how do you do that breathtaking? Well, you just go back to classic, sort of your knowledge of classic cinema, or how your interpretation of that should be. What is breathtaking for you, for me? And or should a scene feel like still, lots of stillness? Then let's photograph it with stillness. Why do you have a dolly shot? You do dolly shot because the language of the film that you have decided on, the language that you've decided on for the film, may be one thing or the other. So for me, it's like important to just kind of go from the start. Like, you have the script, or you have the visual director and the script, the story, and then decide on together with the director on the visual language. And then just grounded in the emotions of the story. That really helps. But in this case, we had the opportunity, or Carrie had opportunity, to co-write then the story in such a way that that you could get larger swathes, or like you go from one dramatic end to another. It could be like really raw and hard, and then it's very soft and tender between scenes, right? And then that we tried to find a way, and he in the writing tried to find a way to go from a cold and icy and isolated and scary, thrilling story, which then takes place in a cold and icy place, and you take that to something very romantic, which later turns and becomes something really hard and brutal, the same location. But we have that sort of in the story already thought of, or Carrie has thought of that in the story, how to let the story move on to become like larger than life as well, and all of like global and take place all over the world and make it like larger. And we just had to be careful about how to connect it with the lighting and with the you know, the camera movements or so to what was going on emotionally. And some scenes could be like, you know, like we have a very long handheld oneer that is just meant to feel very intense and scary. And it's hard both for the character emotionally, that scene should feel really, really hard for him. And I think making a decision to do it handheld was to make it feel harder for him, because on Steadicam or dolly or crane, it actually could have defeated that feeling, you know, not sort of describe that feeling. And I think from scene to scene, you just have to be careful about that and think about what will this feel like when we shoot it this way or light it this way. and at the same time, not necessarily do anything that is just crazy for the effect of it without having the, you know, the emotions in it. So, but I think that's how we, there's combinations of all of that, and then how the colors change between different scenes in order to also play with them again, the emotions really.
Yeah.
So get a variation, get new colors in the new scene. And mm-hmm. there's, for example, the Cuba streets, you know, we shot that in twilight, really not rather twilight. It's like astronomical twilight when the skies are 95% black but 5% blue, so there's still some color of blue in there. And because also a black sky in nights to me feels like contrasty and hard and could describe a scene really well. But in this case, we wanted to also romanticize Cuba, so we made sure that all the skies were dark blue. And so then as well, when we go out on the water with a plane or the and the boats there, it still is like twilight or some sort of dusk twilight, so that you have that color that still gives you the sort of romantic action, you know.
Yeah,
a little more larger than life and heightened. And again, shooting film and anamorphic for all of that felt to us like very much in the vein of the heart of Bond. The Bond franchise itself is like it's the widest, it's the most colorful they can do, shoot on film, anamorphic.
Mm-hmm.
But then on top of that, Carey introduced the idea that it would be really beautiful to give the audience an opportunity too. If you watch it in IMAX, you know that you would see it, you would see the image drop below your feet, in front of you, and above your head, and you're completely engulfed. And so that's why we decided to shoot sequences in the film in IMAX, which they're framed in 2:40, you know, like, so when you see it, maybe when you saw it, it's like a 2:40 image. It's anamorphic 35, and then it's IMAX, so it's sharper and more detailed, obviously, in 2:40, and it's framed for 2:40, so it works in 2:40. But if you're in an IMAX theater, you get a, you know, it just drops below your feet, then
yeah.
You see. You feel like even more engulfed. And that was really just an intention to maximize the experience for the audience, really.
No, totally. I totally get that for sure. We've pretty much reached the end of our time here. So,
okay.
Linus, I'm going to ask you for a one-word answer. Other than No Time to Die, favorite Bond film?
Oh, that's so tricky. It's so tricky because it's so many. But, you know, you grew up with one. I grew up with, like, Roger Moore when I went to the theaters the first time. So, but different times, different. I must say, I don't know. I feel like I must say the most, I think my favorite, I think, is Casino Royale other than No Time to Die.
All right. And one more. No explanation, unfortunately, because we ran out of time here. But creatively, most satisfying scene to shoot in No Time to Die for you?
Oh, I think actually it was the underwater scene, because a lot of, you know, that's something that just connected with me since as far as I can remember, seeing Bond movies is like the underwater stuff in the Bond movies, because they're that actually brought me into scuba diving and at an early age. So I was very much into shooting that. And I thought that what Chris Corbett, our special effects supervisor, built, the construction he did for that set is insane. Like, it's just, I've never been, you know, he's just such an inventor, and he made that set be able to submerge, and it's incredible. So
I agree. It looks amazing.
That was fun to shoot. Yeah.
Yeah. You've done great work on this. Everything that you said rings true, I think, in the visuals here. And we're really, really excited for the progression of your career, reuniting with McKay, Chazelle, and everyone else new that you'll be working with, because you're one of the most exciting DPs around. So congratulations on this film, and we look forward to all the future success for you.
Thank you so much, Matt.
All right. You have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to my interview with the cinematographer for No Time to Die, Lena Sandgren, here on the Next Best Picture podcast. No Time to Die is currently playing in theaters. You have been listening to the Next Best Picture podcast. We are proud to be part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can subscribe to us anywhere where you subscribe to podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can also lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you will get some exclusive podcast content from us. Thank you so much for listening, as always, and we shall see you all next time.
I'm Christina Yerling-Biro, host of the podcast Pop Culture Confidential. Join me as I go way behind the scenes with some of the most influential people in entertainment and media. Hear actors such as Succession's Brian Cox talk about his favorite characters to play.
There always has to be a mystery. The audience have to be in a situation where they want to know what's going on.
Meet studio execs like Pixar chief Pete Docter and learn his secret on how he makes us cry.
Emotion is our first language.
And so many others who are defining popular culture, from Obama speechwriter David Litt to Top Chef host Padma Lakshmi.
We don't often think about food politically, or we don't want to, but it really is.
Join me. Search for Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts.